Physics World.
Hello, I'm Hamish Johnston, and you are very welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. The theme of this week's episode is the communication of physics, so expect lively discussions about outreach, teaching, and other ways of bringing physics to the masses. Later in the podcast, my Physics World colleagues Tammy Freeman and James Dacey will be talking about the MedPhys Slam, a competition in which medical physicists are judged on their ability to communicate with the public. But first up, on Tuesday, I chatted with Helen Heath at the University of Bristol about how the Bristol Institute for Learning and Teaching is using evidence-based techniques to develop best practice in teaching. Helen also talks about how to encourage teenagers to choose to study physics, and also about her work as a particle physicist on the CMS experiment on the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. I've made the journey up the Christmas Steps and then up St. Michael's Hill from Physics World HQ to the University of Bristol. I'm visiting Helen Heath, who's a physicist at the university. She works on particle physics at CERN on the CMS experiment, but she also has a very long interest in education. Helen, you're involved in something called the Bristol Institute of Learning and Teaching. What is that, and how did you get involved, and why?
It's a new initiative at the university to bring more research-based education into universities. So the general thrust in university education has been moving to staff actually having qualifications. And when I started, which is a long time ago, you're appointed, and I don't think we even had to do a presentation on teaching, but nowadays we've become much more professional with our attitude to teaching. And the Bristol Institute of Learning and Teaching is another move towards that, gathering together academics who are particularly interested in teaching and perhaps particularly interested in the research behind teaching and how one teaches at university level. So the idea is that there are different ways people can be associated with the Institute. And I look on it, I'm a fellow, which means I work for them 2 days a week. And I've got an interest in something called program level assessment, which is looking at moving the assessment of a university degree from just the individual modules that students do to assessing the overall profile, if you like, and how one goes about doing that within the university system. So I've been doing that for a year, and I've got another year to work on that. So the idea of people like me, fellows, I think, is that we are supposed to do the research and understand what's going on in research in higher education and then propagate that out to our colleagues who maybe haven't got the time. We haven't all got the time to spend a lot of time reading educational journals, but what we're doing is, the fellows are doing, is extracting the things that are really particularly relevant to our colleagues and trying to help them improve their teaching, make it based on the research on how it's best to teach people in higher education. So that's the role, really.
Is this a way to sort of deal with the tension, or sometimes there's a tension between research and teaching? Because, you know, sometimes, you know, you can hear an academic say, oh, I'm looking forward to next semester because I don't have to do any teaching and I can focus on my research. Is that still an issue in higher education?
There is undoubtedly a tension between, and what you're asking academics to do is you're asking them to perform research at the highest level. The sort of research I do, physics research that I do, is based abroad. So I'm on two particle physics experiments and they're both in Geneva. So there's a difficulty there with travel and with, you know, meetings being held, say, at odd times, for example. They quite often have meetings that start at 9 o'clock in the morning in Switzerland. Well, that's 8 o'clock in the morning here. So you may have to come in really early to do a video meeting. You may feel that you need to be there in person. So that's demanding. Being in the laboratory is demanding. You can't just drop an experiment because someone's knocked on the door. So the tension's there. Most of my colleagues, I would say, really actually enjoy teaching. They enjoy the contact with the students, but they're trying to do two difficult jobs at the same time. And it's the tension between that that's the problem, not that they don't want to teach. That's the difficulty. And I think by, you know, the idea is that if we can make people feel confident about what they're doing teaching-wise, so they feel that what they're doing is based in best practice, they feel that it should work, they're confident with the students in explaining to them what they're doing and that they're doing it for good reason, if you can build people's confidence in their teaching, then actually it takes them less time and they feel happier about it, and that reduces the tension. The more you feel confident in a role, the easier it is for you to do, I think.
So I know you teach, you're an enthusiastic teacher. What have you learned from your involvement with the Institute? You know, how have you put that into practice in your day-to-day lectures and how you deal with students?
Well, I've started to think, I mean, it's, you know, it's a massive subject of research and education. So what I'm the first year coordinator. That's one of my big teaching roles. And I've started to look at how we can help the students, you know, who are struggling with the material. So there are some students who come in and they'll succeed, and they'll almost succeed whatever we do, because they just find some of it very easy to get. But there are students who struggle with some concepts, and so what I've been looking at and I'm thinking about, and we're meeting this week to talk about, is how we help students. It's called scaffolding what they're learning, so that the students who struggle with material, one of the things they struggle with is extracting the really key points. And it feels like they're awash with information coming from the lecture and they don't know what to do with it. One of the things I've started trying to think about much more clearly in my teaching is what's the most important things that you need to do, and what are, you know, sort of there's a hierarchy of, you know, really, really important, absolutely basic things that if you don't get that, you can't move on. And then thinking about how I communicate that to the students. And the best students will get everything you tell them. And the students who, you know, are struggling with a concept, it may be that that concept isn't so important and actually something else is more important. So it's you know, so making sure that the foundations are firm. People progress at different rates. I mean, I've realised, I said best, and I'm not even sure that that's the right word. Sometimes it just takes time to grasp things. And when you've grasped it, maybe that because you've struggled with it, that your understanding is actually better than somebody who just sort of thought, oh, it's obvious. So it's not necessarily that the students can't do it, but it's helping them to build that scaffold on which their knowledge is based, and that firm scaffold so they can move on to the more abstract topics perhaps later on in the course.
And is that an approach that you know, that can be or is being used in secondary education? Because, of course, you know, one of the peculiarities of the English education system is that someone has to choose to do physics when they're 16. And yeah. If they don't make that choice, then that's it for their physics education. Mm. And I would imagine that some of the things that you've been speaking about are very relevant for 15, 16-year-olds who, you know, maybe have progressed at different levels. And
Yes, and I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about the education at the moment is the post-16. Actually, things are just changing, and they're changing much more back to the way that I was taught, where you have a final examination on everything that you did in your sixth form studies. And I think there's a move both in university and in school education away from the sort of modularisation of material, so compartmentalising knowledge, perhaps reducing things into chunks that you can cram in at the last minute and then sort of forget about. And I think that's part of this scaffolding there, is that, you know, it may look like that foundation is there because you did a module and you were all right, but if you did it in the first year of your sixth form studies, by the time you get to university, that's 2 years ago, and you may have forgotten that because you didn't revisit it. And there's both this program level assessment project that we're thinking about, and the A-level post-16 education is moving a bit more to thinking of the subject as a whole. And it is important that, you know, you physics is a subject which builds on what you did before. Sometimes that building process involves dismantling your ideas a little bit, but actually it's if the foundations aren't there, then you won't work after a while.
So how would you convince a 16-year-old that they should make the choice and go into physics? Because it is a big choice for somebody of that age, and I think people are very daunted by physics. What sort of strategies would you use to encourage somebody to do that?
Physics isn't a soft option. I think everyone knows that, and the Institute of Physics has done considerable amount of research on that, and to some extent physics can be seen to be hard in terms of the results people get compared with their GCSE results, and I think that's an issue that the Institute of Physics that the Institute of Physics has been looking into. But it is a challenging subject, but obviously it's an incredibly exciting subject, an incredibly broad subject, from the sort of very mathematical end, where and we have theoretical physicists who work in maths departments and mathematicians who work in physics departments. So there's that theoretical mathematical part. There's working in the laboratory, building things, and there's a lot of practical applications. I'm a particle physicist. And you think that's probably very blue skies. It's not directly related to anything practical. That can be the perception. But I've got colleagues who've done doing work with medical physics, because some of our scanning techniques can be used in medical physics. Looking at sort of homeland security, so techniques for detecting heavy metals, for example, buried inside large shipping containers, so that we can avoid these dangerous things being brought into the country. And also looking, using cosmic radiation to study volcanoes to see whether they might be about to explode. And we've had a few sort of natural disasters recently, so that sort of thing. So there are practical applications, even these subjects that you might think are just done sort of for pure intellectual interests, like
getting girls interested in physics has been a very difficult problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you see progress being made in that direction, and if so, how is it being made?
I've seen quite a lot of progress in women continuing in physics once they get to university. And so when I started here, I was the first full-time lecturer, female lecturer in the department. So, and there are, some of them have joint appointments, so we could be, we're talking 6 or 7 now. So that's a big change that I've seen. Big change in the number of students, female students doing postgraduate work. The number of change and then moving into lectureships and so on. So that's changing, and I believe that our staff now much more accurately reflects the proportion of women that we have at undergraduate level, which is not true in many subjects, actually. So physics beats itself up about the number of women, but in fact, in terms of retention, I think things are improving dramatically.
So the leaky pipeline is maybe not as leaky as it used to be.
I don't think it's as leaky as it used to be. But the problem that we have, and again, something I was involved in the IOP Opening Doors project, and there's all sorts of issues which appear to be cultural with getting people into the pipeline in the first place. I know there's a lot of work on sort of school culture in schools, and it's what struck me many years ago. I mean, I've worked on getting women into physics for a very long time, and many years ago I went to one of the international conferences on women in physics, and what is really notable is the variation from country to country in the percentage of physics undergraduates that are female. And it really varies dramatically. And in the Paris conference, which is the first one I went to, it was from about 5% to something over 50. And it wasn't necessarily the countries that you might stereotypically think had large numbers of women that had large numbers of women. And it's to do with all sorts of things. It's to do, for example, with the perception of physics versus engineering and the kudos associated with doing those different subjects. And it's associated with what people can do with their degrees when they've finished. And so I think there's a real cultural issue which needs to be tackled. And progress on that is a lot slower because it's a much more difficult thing to change. But what I am sure about is there's a lot of women out there who have the potential to succeed in physics and are put off, and I wish we could find ways to stop them being put off.
I mean, one thing that I've noticed, you know, this, I suppose this could be a cultural thing, in going to various different physics conferences, is that even within the field of physics, there is a huge disparity in the number of women involved. For example, astronomy. You go to an astronomy conference, you will find a lot of women there, and a lot of very senior women.
Yes.
Whereas condensed matter physics, for example, it remains a very, very male-heavy field. So, I mean, is that something that you think is a problem in the UK and that can be addressed, or are there more important things to deal with?
Yeah, I think there is a problem, and I think you're absolutely right, and I recognise what you said about different proportions in different subject areas. I'm not sure whether I regard that as the priority, and I think, you know, people need to think about that, and I would ask, you know, that people who are involved in subject areas where there are very few women might ask themselves why. I don't think, you know, intellectually it's because there's anything special about these various subject areas. So there is something about the way, I mean, it's probably cultural. There's so many factors that affect what subject you do when you move on. Let's try and address getting the girls into physics in the first place. And from my point of view, I think that would be my priority.
So Helen, your other interest is particle physics. You're a member of the CMS collaboration on the LHC.
Yes.
And I mean, I think it's safe to say that the LHC is a fantastic machine. It's been running extremely well for years now.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the experiments as well have been running very well.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there was the Higgs boson that was discovered, which was a triumph. But unfortunately, and maybe unfortunately is a loaded word, there doesn't seem to be much coming out of LHC experiments. You know, there's been, I suppose, lots of papers confirming various aspects of the standard model, which you would expect. But, you know, there hasn't really been a zinger in terms of physics beyond the standard model. And I just wonder, does that concern you? And where do you see particle physics going post-LHC?
Does it concern me? I don't know whether it concerns me. One of the problems with publishing and the sort of research you do is that we look for things, and we spend a long time thinking where we might look for things. And if people spent quite a long time thinking about where the Higgs was, and then it turned up, and I think people were confident that it would turn up. The stage we're in now is we're looking and excluding a lot of potential models for what might be next. And those papers, you know, there are many papers being published. We're publishing 100 and something papers a year. So there's a lot of work going on. One of the problems with perhaps getting interested in is not finding something isn't very interesting. So there's a lot of work and a lot of elimination of possibilities going on. If we find nothing more, then that in itself becomes interesting. If the Higgs boson is just the Higgs boson of the Standard Model, then you sort of end up with a slight philosophical problem, because there's a fine tuning in the universe, which means that if you tweak things slightly, then the universe looks very, very different, and we wouldn't be here to observe it, and that brings up some philosophical issues. There are hints that the Standard Model isn't quite right. They're just not coming from these general purpose detectors at the LHC, because the Higgs at the moment looks like the Standard Model Higgs. So we're pretty sure there's something there, and it may be that we're starting, and there are lots of experiments proposed to look in other places to try and, so looking in the physics of neutrinos and so on, to try and dig a bit deeper as to what's going on. I'm on CMS, but I'm also on another experiment called NO62, which is looking at a slightly different way of trying to find out about physics beyond the Standard Model, that possibly at energy scale, so for particles that are much more massive than you might see with the LHC. So there's lots of things going on in the field of particle physics, and I think if we genuinely find nothing other than the Standard Model of Higgs, then that is interesting. But of course, there are lots of models, and we're still looking. And as I always used to tell my children when they were little, everything is always in the last place you look.
So I'm guessing that you have discussions with colleagues, and perhaps you're even involved in informal discussions about what comes next after the sort of planned progression of the LHC. Do you have any favorites in terms of the next collider? Would it be a sort of a Higgs machine, a linear collider, or maybe a larger version of the LHC? Or you haven't made your mind up yet.
I'm not sure that I have a some of these is a muon collider proposal, which sounds interesting. There's a lot of interesting proposals around. I think some of these experiments in neutrinos, so there are reactor experiments and so on, maybe not even a collider, might be interesting. But I think we need a hint. That's what we're looking for, a hint of where to go next before we can really say that's what we need to do.
And do you have any sort of personal theories? any favorites, let's say, for where that hint is going to come from? You mentioned neutrino physics. Of course, there's lots of precision particle physics measuring magnetic moments and radii and masses. Do you have any inklings for where it could come from, or do you think it's wide open?
I think it's quite wide open at the moment, and I'm not, I don't know, maybe I like to feel that nature would surprise us, partly because the Higgs boson was predicted for a long time, and then we went out and then we found it, and that was great, and I remember sitting in a lecture theatre in this building when the announcement was coming through, and when they made the announcement, it's the only time I genuinely felt the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, and you sort of I thought, oh, I'll be sitting in a cold lecture theatre, and I think we all know what's coming, but actually when you hear the announcement, it doesn't matter that you know that it's coming, it did feel like something had been achieved, but it was expected, and I quite like my inkling was, wouldn't it be something wonderful to find something that you owe, hang on, we didn't order that, at the sort of moment where we got quarks that we didn't order earlier on in history. so I'm looking, I'd like a, my personal preference would be for a we didn't order that type moment.
And I suppose, from the point of view of somebody starting out in their career as a particle physicist today. The landscape is incredible in terms of the experiments. I mean, there's traditional collider experiments. You've got neutrino experiments.
Yes.
You've got precision measurements in the lab that are know, optics or even condensed matter physics experiments.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, is that is that what, you know, let's say a postgrad or a postdoc are excited about these days? I mean, do you hear people talking, well, I could do a muon magnetic moment, or I could go into the proton radius, or I could go to CERN, or...
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think CERN still has a, going to CERN still has a sort of cachet about it, doesn't it? You know, people have heard of CERN, you know, even people who aren't, don't have much interest in physics have heard of CERN. So I think that that's still an attraction for students. And but I hope that they get intrigued by these other experiments, and we certainly, you know, we've got plenty of excellent students on both on the LHC experiments and on the smaller experiments, and there's an advantage to those in that you are so my other experiment has about 180 physicists as opposed to 2,000 on CMS, so it's a little bit easier for younger people to make their mark on these slightly smaller experiments,
right,
and have a piece of the experiment that's there. And also the timescale's shorter, so they can be involved in construction and then testing and then moving forward to actually starting to analyse the results on a timescale of a few years rather than, how long have I been working on CMS? I started working on CMS when I came back from my second bout of maternity leave, and that daughter is now 23.
Right.
so it's a long, long time scale.
So this is this NA experiment where NA has nothing to do with sodium.
No, NA is just stands for North Area at CERN. So
right.
The areas at CERN are designated, and you get a number. So unless you want to come up with a nicer nicer name, then you get stuck with your NA, whatever it is.
Recently, Tammy Freeman was at the annual meeting of the American Association of Physicists in Medicine, which was held in Nashville, Tennessee. There, she was very impressed by a session called the MedPhys Slam. She tells James Dacey all about it.
So Tammy, you just returned from Nashville, where you went to the annual meeting of the AAPM. So what's the purpose of that event, and who goes to it?
Okay, so AAPM is the American Association of Physicists in Medicine, and their annual meeting brings together thousands of medical physicists from around the world. The meeting's held in a different city every summer, and this year it was in Nashville, Tennessee, which is known as the Music City and is renowned for its country music heritage. It was actually a great place to hold the meeting. The official conference night out was held at the Country Music Hall of Fame. There was a live band playing all night, and they also held some line dancing lessons to get the physicists on the dance floor. So, it was a successful meeting all around.
Well, so the theme for this year's event was Beyond the Future, which, you know, it sounds pretty bold. What do they actually mean by that?
Well, the idea here is that medical physics faces many potential challenges and threats. For example, cuts to funding for medical physics research, changes in clinical practice and reimbursement for medical treatments. There's also a lot of changes in technology. For example, the increase in automation and the use of AI, for example. So to adapt for the future, the medical physics community needs to understand these challenges and how to face them and how to plan far ahead. So this theme was reflected in the President's Symposium, where the current president, Bruce Tomlinson, noted that as well as trying to answer the questions that we know about, we also need to consider the unknown unknowns, or things that we don't even think about now. One of the speakers in this symposium, Robert Uroy, explained that for medical physics to function, it needs to be able to connect cutting-edge research with translational research, improvements in technology, and ultimately move to clinical implementation. He suggested that medical physicists should remember their physics roots and draw from this, for example, creating large worldwide collaborations. He suggested creating a CERN for medical physics.
Well, it's aiming high then.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned there was a talk, then the president gave an address, but what was the general format for the event? I mean, and was there anything linked with Nashville as well, you know, related to music, for example?
Well, some of the speakers did reference country music and play clips in their talks, but in general, it was your typical scientific meeting. So there was 5 days covering all aspects of medical physics. So that's diagnostic imaging, the latest treatment techniques, and also the areas where imaging and therapy overlap. So there was a mix of symposia, panel discussions, courses, poster sessions. And there was also some joint symposia with related societies, such as the World Molecular Imaging Society and ESTRO, which is the European Society for Radiotherapy and Oncology. There was also a large industry exhibition, which this year had around 100 vendors displaying their products. There were also some special events. So, for example, the Best in Physics session, which showcases the studies that score the highest in the review process. There's a Young Investigators Symposium. And this year, there was a brand new event called the MedPhys Slam.
Well, so that sounds pretty intriguing. It's different from some of the events I've been to. So what's a MedPhys Slam exactly?
Okay, so the MedPhys Slam is basically a communication competition. So the participants, who could be PhD students, medical physics residents, and sort of early postdoctoral researchers, they had just 3 minutes to describe their research project in a compelling and coherent manner. So the idea here, obviously, effective communication skills are important for anyone pursuing a scientific career. But if you're training to be a medical physicist, you've got to think you'll inevitably come into contact with patients, their relatives, other staff in the hospital, and you need the ability to explain complex ideas and concepts in a really clear and understandable manner. So the competition was actually judged by a panel of non-medical physicists. So this included local newspaper and radio journalists. There was a physics teacher, a PhD student who was studying learning and teaching and diversity. And there was also Matraca Berg, who is a Nashville-born country music singer and songwriter. So having this sort of non-expert panel was a really great idea, because if they didn't understand what the speaker was talking about, then they're obviously not going to give them very high ratings. So the slam was held in one of the big meeting rooms, pulled in a large crowd. It was quite an informal atmosphere. There was a lot of cheering people on from the speakers, colleagues and friends. And also, as well as the judges picking a winner, the audience got to vote on their people's choice.
So who actually won it then? Who won the overall competition? Who did the judges pick?
Okay, so the overall winner was Ashley Tao, who was a medical physics resident at the Mayo Clinic. Her talk had quite an intriguing title. So it was called "The Textbook Was Wrong. The X-ray tube does contribute substantially to occupational radiation dose during fluoroscopy." It's quite a long title, but basically fluoroscopy is a type of medical imaging that uses continuous X-ray imaging. And she was looking about the dose that the operators get during this procedure. She described a new approach to reducing this dose, and she sort of emphasised the need for radiation safety education. So she was chosen as the overall winner. But there were 16 presentations. They were all really good standard. The speakers were only allowed to use very few slides. And the judges actually noted that the talks with less slides were the better ones. And you could tell the presenters have made a real effort to simplify their work and explain it in a way that the non-physicists could understand. So there were some other novel ideas presented. One talk was called "How a Robot Could Make Us Better Marksmen." And this looked at reducing treatment margins by moving the patient on a robotic couch during radiotherapy. Another talk suggested replacing anaesthesia with Netflix for children undergoing radiotherapy.
Sure, they'd be up for that.
Yeah, so I mean, the problem is radiotherapy is normally given in 20 to 30 treatment fractions. So it's a big benefit if you don't need to anaesthetise the patient for every one of those sessions. So the speaker noted that this approach was already in use and that they'd found they could treat about 90% of 3 to 12-year-olds without needing anaesthetic.
Wow.
So maybe Netflix does work.
So I guess, you know, like you said, it's just an inevitable part of being a medical physicist is that at some point, or quite regularly in some cases, you're going to have to speak with lots of different people, and actual patients as well. So there's an emotional element to that. And You obviously, in your job as a medical physics journalist, you come across quite a few medical physicists and researchers. And do you get the feeling that's a side of the job they actually enjoy?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you've got to realise there's a broad range of roles within medical physics. So as well as working in the clinical roles, medical physicists work within industry, for example, in R&D, but also in customer support and areas like that where they need these communication skills. There's also jobs, obviously, in academic research and education, areas such as radiation safety, regulatory positions, and work on science policy. So there's a very broad range. But one thing that always strikes me about the medical physicists that I meet is their great enthusiasm. In general, they do all seem to be good communicators. They seem really keen on collaboration. Many people also are working, for example, to bring the benefits of medical physics technologies to developing countries via education programs and that sort of thing. And as I said before, they're also pretty enthusiastic on the dance floor.
Well, great. Well, I guess it makes your job easier if they can talk to you.
Absolutely.
Tell you what they're doing. Well, thanks, Tammy. Then. Thank you.
Thanks, Tammy and James. There's much more about Tammy's trip to Nashville on the Physics World website. Now for news highlights from Physics World. Managing solar radiation by introducing aerosols into the atmosphere may not protect crop yields from climate change. That's according to Jonathan Proctor of the University of California, Berkeley, and colleagues, who have found that reduced heat stress resulting from this geoengineering may not outweigh the harm to crop yield from the scattering of sunlight that occurs. Shading the planet keeps things cooler, which helps crops grow better, says Proctor. But plants also need sunlight to grow, so blocking sunlight can affect growth, he adds. It seemed impossible, but two mathematicians in the US have come up with a way of snapping a strand of dried spaghetti into exactly two pieces. Ronald Heiser and Vishal Patil have shown that twisting the spaghetti strand before bending it dissipates vibrations in the strand that would normally cause multiple breakages. Their research is the latest breakthrough in a story that began decades ago when physicists, including the Nobel laureate Richard Feynman, tried to answer the deceptively simple question, why do strands of dried spaghetti almost always snap into three or more pieces when bent? A theoretical study has modeled how radio waves behave when passing through the Great Pyramid at Giza in Egypt. Mikhail Balazin and colleagues at St. Petersburg's ITMO University in Russia and Germany's Laserzentrum in Hanover have used multipole analysis to approximate how the electromagnetic waves would be influenced by the famous landmark. They suggest that the waves could be focused by the pyramid and also be concentrated within internal chambers, as well as offering a new way to study the interiors of huge structures. The technique could also be used to characterize tiny nanoparticles that are pyramidal in shape. For more about these stories and a lively mix of physics news, features, reviews, and analysis, check out the Physics World website. Thanks again for joining us, and we will be back next week with more from the wonderful world of physics.
Physics World.